The topic this morning is a social justice slash woke movement. And as I was just telling Rich, I spent a lot of time taking notes and listening to different podcasts and not a whole lot of time trying to figure out how I'm going to digest it all and what I'm going to focus on. So it's a lot of information and, you know, I'll just, you know, cover what I can. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the history of the ideas. Just kind of go over some definitions and enough background to kind of let everybody know what, you know, where these things came from. And then just kind of focus on the main ideas of the movements and how they're affecting our church and culture. So I want to start with a few definitions because there's a lot of terms that are thrown around, you know, in this area. The first is social justice. This is just the first Google definition that I saw. Apparently it's from Oxford Languages. It's justice in terms of the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. William H. Young, who served in George H. Bush's administration, has done a recent series of articles on social justice, defines it as social justice has evolved generally to mean state redistribution of resources and advantages to disadvantaged groups to satisfy their right to social and economic equality. Now, there's similar definitions, and probably the key thing here is that when they're talking about redistributing wealth and jobs and other things, it doesn't really matter how those wealth or positions were gained. It's considered unfair regardless of how it was earned if you were in what's called an advantaged group. One person I'll do a lot from is Bodie Balcom. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with him. He's a black pastor who is now head of, a Bible college somewhere in Africa. He's done a lot of work on this. He's even been on some things like Glenn Beck and some kind of bigger conservative shows. He made the point that you could be from the dirt poor family in Appalachia, become wealthy through just nothing but hard, honest work, and it's still considered unjust because you're in a privileged group. By the same token, you could be one of the Obama daughters and you're still oppressed in some sense because you're in a disadvantaged group. Note also, I'm using the term groups and not minorities because, for one thing, there's more women than men, but women are considered a disadvantaged group, even though they're not a minority. And by the same token, there are some minorities now that are, it's kind of questionable whether they're considered disadvantaged or not. Just the last week or two, I've seen a few things about some school districts in California, considering lumping in Asians with whites, because of their performance. And some are saying because of voting patterns among Hispanics that they are maybe part of the white race too. So, now, if you, for any reason, say that there is some disparity from in this group, or the disparity in this group is from something other than racism, this is considered victim blaming, and it's not allowed within this train of thought. One other note on this: the redistribution. Rich talked about poverty last week and noted that there's some huge problems and unintended consequences when some outside force, which is always the government, starts redistributing things. The bad effects are both on those whose things are taken from and also sometimes to those who are given things that they didn't necessarily work or earn themselves. Next term is wokeness, which is a political term, again, the official definition. A political term originating in the United States referring to perceived awareness of issues concerning social justice and racial justice. As the term kind of implies, you somehow wake up to see that these issues are going on. A lot of times, you know, the belief is that you're kind of blinded from them. A little bit like the movie in The Matrix where you take the red pill and you open up your eyes and see that you've been living in some kind of artificial world. Although others, like myself, think it's kind of the opposite. The woke view is actually what's pretty much promoted everywhere in the mainstream media, public schools and colleges, Hollywood, pop culture, messages we get from large corporations. So it seems to me rather it's the woke are kind of living in the matrix, but you know, that's not the way they see it. Next is intersectionality, defined as when race, class, gender, even disability or physical appearance create overlapping and interdependent systems of discrimination or disadvantage. So this is like, you know, if you're in, you might be in one disadvantaged group or multiple disadvantaged groups. You could be a black female or Hispanic, homosexual, that sort of thing. Another term kind of related to this is the oppression Olympics, which I always thought was kind of a joke. I thought that was people kind of sort of poking fun at this, but that term was actually coined by feminists in the 1990s, described as a contest within a group to assert who is more authentic, more oppressed, and thus more correct. And actually, they didn't want oppressed groups competing with each other, but rather they wanted to harness our rage. Sounds nice. Harness our rage at persisting injustices in order to strengthen our opposition. Just a kind of personal side note on what I've just noticed. I really think the whole intersectionality idea is kind of goes out the window really quickly because you can be in multiple disadvantaged groups and still be, you know, attacked whether literally or figuratively. One example is Andy Ngo. He's a Asian man of Vietnamese descent. He's also a homosexual, and he's an independent journalist. He's done a lot of work trying to expose Antifa and the violence and the illegal activities and things that they've done. And he's literally been attacked, almost beaten to death once, several times, as well as just constantly slandered online. So, you know, apparently his intersectional qualifications don't do him any good. And I've also seen black women at some of the protests either speaking up for pro-life positions or speaking for the wrong candidate or wearing the right, you know, wrong clothes indicating that, and, you know, being attacked verbally or even physically. So this kind of seems to go out the window pretty quickly if you're not holding to the correct views. There's also cultural Marxism. Now this one, if you try to look it up, like in Wikipedia, it says it's basically a right-wing conspiracy. I think it's a valid term, but a lot of people try to question it, and I think both Vodi Balcom and Neil Shinvey, somebody else, another really good resource for this, on a lot of podcasts and has a website, Shinvey Apologetics. Both of them think it's probably not the best term to use, just because people will deny their, you know, they'll say I'm not a Marxist and there's no such thing as cultural Marxism. So, well, I think it's a valid idea. You know, it may not be the best term to describe it, or people, you're going to get a lot of resistance right away. And then finally, we have the term that both Vodi and Neil Shinvey think is the real umbrella, the real kind of main issue that everything else is under, which is critical race theory, which is based on critical theory, which came much earlier. And this is the view that the law and legal institutions are inherently racist, and that race itself, instead of being biologically grounded and natural, is a socially constructed concept used by white people to further their economic and political interest at the expense of people of color. Vodi says, CRT, critical race theory, sees the world as oppressed versus oppressors and sees equity as redistributing power from oppressor to oppressed. Equity is another term that you'll hear a lot, and really basically the best way to define equity is, you know, it sounds kind of like equality, but in equality there's a very big difference between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. You know, equality of opportunity is, we'd almost all agree, is a good thing. Everybody should have the same opportunity, shouldn't be discriminated against. But trying to force an equality of outcome is a very different thing, and that's really what equity is. Again, critical race theory came from the idea of critical theory, which originated in the Frankfurt School in the 1930s in Germany. It was based on both Marxism and some other ideas from different philosophers and psychologists. It was influenced by some other earlier Marxist, one of the particular was Antonio Gramsci, who basically believed Marxism could kind of overcome or supersede religion if it met people's spiritual needs. He also said mastery over the great mass of people could be attained if communists or their sympathizers gained control I'm sorry, this is not a direct quote. This is a description of what he believed. Mastery over the great mass of people could be attained if communists or their sympathizers gained control over the organs of culture, churches, education, newspapers, magazines, literature, music, the visual arts, and so on. So by doing this, communism would control the deepest wellsprings of human thought. So he kind of pushed for a less violent, you know, a hopefully nonviolent form of Marxism that kind of won over the hearts and minds of people. One of his later followers coined the term the long march through the institutions, which is the same idea of gradually having an intellectual takeover of churches, educational facilities, entertainment, and that sort of thing. Critical theory, the larger school of critical theory, also includes forms of feminism, critical law theory, queer theory, and other things. But right now, critical race theory is the most important offshoot. Just last year, 2019, the Southern Baptist Convention, the SBC, had their annual meeting and said of critical race theory that it's can be an analytical tool that can aid in evaluating a variety of human experiences. It did note that it's not on par with Scripture, but it did, you know, it's saying that it's a, you know, it could be a helpful tool that we can use. But others, on the other hand, believe that it's really just a Trojan horse, if you remember that story from mythology, that it looks good, at least to some people on the outside, but it has huge problems inside. One person who said that is James Lindsay, who's actually an atheist. He was a big part of the New Atheist movement that was popular about 15 years ago. He's now a really big critic of a lot of these ideas. And he said it just ate up the New Atheism. It became so consumed with whether this person said something racist 30 years ago or, you know, made some joke that was not politically correct, that it just started going after their own and they couldn't have any more conferences or, you know, real teachings or anything that were helpful. And when somebody posed this question about the church, you know, he said it's going to do the same thing to the church, and that even if you try to do a softer form of it, eventually it's going to grow into this. It's kind of like George Orwell once said in one of his essays, talked about a mask. If you wear a mask, your face will grow to fit it, you know, eventually. You can try to kind of partially, you know, cover it in some ways and say we're only going to take bits and pieces of it, but, you know, eventually it's going to start become kind of all consuming. But this is a little bit of a long passage, but I thought it was very interesting. It's from a lady named Chinwan Snyder who grew up in communist China and came to the U.S. in graduate school. She went on to study, I think she got a PhD at Duke Divinity School, went to several other places. But, you know, growing up in communist China herself, and I'm sure hearing stories from her parents and grandparents about all the things that went on in China and the Cultural Revolution, all that they had, she had a kind of a unique background to see this. And she says that critical race theory claims that America was built on white supremacy from its beginnings. It's a racist country, best understood through the narrative of oppressors and victims. It sets up whites as oppressors against the rest, the victims. Salvation or damnation depend on the group to which one belongs, white or non-white. Marxists have used similar tactics in other places to acquire dominance, but Marxists have always used issues such as race as a prop. The idea with CRT is not to solve real racial problems, but rather to gain political power, again, with the aim of reconstructing society. It tries to create a new reality. People no longer exist as individuals responsible for their own behavior. Their identity is based on group membership instead. The group white persons has in the past committed grave wrongs and inequities continue today. Therefore, all whites are guilty. When a crime is unjustly applied to a mass of people, it creates a gigantic invisible wave. Individuals feel powerless to resist. This is why identity politics is so formidable. CRT creates an impersonal reality in which individuality is greatly diminished. We will start to lose the will to oppose even absurd ideas. And we will talk in a few minutes about some of the absurdity with this. Besides that, each of us has this sense of original sin deep in our hearts. We long for deliverance. CRT provides a natural way to express remorse. It's a secular means of salvation. It not only alters one's view of reality, it provides a rare redemptive opportunity that the soul craves. It's been used as a racial sensitivity training material throughout every stratum of society. We still have a window of opportunity to reject CRT, and we must. Otherwise, it will sweep through the nation like a hurricane. Our nation as a whole will lose its ability to resist. The people will surrender their will and give up their rights and freedoms to it without firing a shot. Which kind of goes again to Gramsci's goal of, you know, a bloodless sort of revolution. It's also worth noting that in the early communist years of China, they had something called struggle sessions that they used to shame people. The aim of this was to shape public opinion and humiliate, persecute, or execute political rivals and their deemed class enemies. Similar practices of criticism and self-criticism were used in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. Usually these involved academics or intellectuals who were forced to confess their views that went against the regime in power. You know, while we don't have this, fortunately, sometimes this involved actual physical beatings and torture and these type of things. It was actually sanctioned by the state. You do kind of see sort of early versions of it, such as a video that came earlier this summer where protesters are going to restaurants and surrounding people at tables and trying to get them to raise up their fist and sort of a solidarity, either Black Lives Matter or whatever movement that they were, you know, that they were in there promoting, and, you know, yelling at them, kind of bullying them just by having a big mob of people. The last term, there are more, but the last one I'll just kind of cover here is called anti-racism. This sounds good to a lot of people because, you know, if you're not for something, you're against it. We all want to be against racism. But what this really means is it's not enough to be colorblind or just not a racist. When you do this, it's just really a mask for racism. Unless you see real racism's real roots and power and policies and actively fight it, you're a racist. Now, the Bible's view on racism is quite different, and I think it could be summed up best by simply saying it's no partiality. And this is pretty much kind of what most people, I think, were taught, at least in the generations when I grew up. You know, don't judge people by their class or their skin color. Treat everyone as individuals with respect, that sort of thing. Some verses that talk about partiality. James 2:1 says, "My brothers, show no partiality as you hold faith in Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory." Peter in Acts 10 says, "Truly I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him." Any nation. Romans 2:11, "For God shows no partiality." Galatians 3:28, "There is no Jew nor Greek, there is no slave nor free, there is no male nor female, for you are all one in Christ." 1 Timothy 5:21, "In the presence of God and of Jesus Christ and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality." Leviticus 19:15, "You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor." And also, I didn't write down the reference, but in Ephesians, there's a verse or a couple of verses that also talk about leaving all bitterness, wrath, and anger behind, which I think is sort of a kind of a byproduct of a lot of what we see in critical race theory and some of these other views. There's many other verses that talk about partiality. In Deuteronomy 1, it says that judges should be fair and partial in judgment, whether you're dealing with Israelites or aliens to be judged. So I haven't really read anybody say this exactly, but just my own kind of personal observation with this kind of whole woke and social justice movement is it seems to kind of run in cycles, going from the LGBTQ plus, I don't know what it is. I think I'll just call it the alphabet people, like some people say, because I can't keep up with all the letters and so forth, but that was maybe, I think, kind of the end of of President Obama's last year or so, when all the talk was about who could use what bathroom, and especially the trans movement, you know, was really taking hold. From there, it went to the Me Too movement. Kind of everything was about that. You know, women were kind of always right when they were making an accusation against a man. And then it's gone on to race, especially this past year and this past summer. So I'm mostly going to kind of focus on the CRT, critical race theory, again, because that's just kind of what we're facing right now. It's kind of as a side note, I've just wondered that, and I have no opinion, and I've never really looked into the whole Bill Cosby allegations and whether he's guilty or not, but I thought, you know, he had really bad timing, because that was all during the Me Too movement, when every time a woman, you know, accused a man of any kind of a rape or assault or anything, he was pretty much just judged guilty on the internet and everywhere else, you know, before, just instantly. And, you know, just kind of wondered what would have happened if it happened when race was a big focus. If, you know, if a white woman was accusing him of something, maybe people wouldn't have believed it. But it just kind of, like I said, depends where we are in the cycle, what, you know, what the kind of issue of the day is. But on a little bit to critical race theory, one of the really popular books that's recommended, this was a bestseller for weeks and weeks, recommended a lot on education, job training, and even some churches. It was called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And in this book, DiAngelo teaches that, first of all, that we have a social binary, that for every group there's an opposite group in race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, or disability, religion, nationality, that every group there's some kind of binary, there's some kind of opposite. So, again, not like what the Bible teaches about there being no Greek, no Jew, no Gentile. You know, there, in her view, there truly is. You're basically either in the privileged group or the oppressed group. And as noted earlier, it's victim blaming, or in her term, aversive racism, if you attribute anything besides racism to explain differences in these groups. Neil Shinvey notes that on the topic of oppression, that what when they, you know, oppression is usually talked about by people like DiAngelo, it's not really the classic definition of which is a cruel and prolonged unjust treatment and control, like what you'd think of as what would happen in a concentration camp, or maybe less seriously, you know, with a prolonged school bullying or something like that. The new definition is it's not necessarily about tyrannical power. It's because of everyday tendencies in a well-intentioned liberal society. And by just promoting things like meritocracy, like a merit-based system where people are promoted or rewarded on how well they do, hard work, those things can be forms of oppression. You don't necessarily have to take any specific action, like intentionally discriminating against somebody, using a racial slur, or that sort of thing to be oppressive. It really goes back to both Marx and Gramsci. Gramsci believed that he couldn't really explain why workers weren't just getting up and revolting if things were as bad as he says, and so his explanation was that they were taking part in their own oppression and they need to be woken up, which, you know, I guess that was the first woke person. You're complicit. You're part of this racist culture based on your group or your social location. Based on intersectionality, you can be oppressed in some areas, but not others. So you could be a white woman who's privileged because of your race, but and disadvantaged because you're a woman. Critical race theory says that a person of color has lived experience that helps them see through the lies in the society around them. However, the oppressor is blinded to the reality of their oppression, and this is that this woke person can see because they are a person of color or a woman or LGBTQ or some other category. And the really key thing is the oppressor has a better access to truth. James Lindsay says, you have to defer to life experiences of the oppressed. So if they say that they know something because of their experiences, you have really no option but to agree with it. That's their truth, and it's a deeper truth than you can have if you're in a so-called dominant group. He gives example of of color. If you're in a totally dominant group, white male, heterosexual, you're healthy, etc., it's like you see the word in grace, you see the world in grayscale. But for every group outside of this, you can add a color. You know, if you're a woman, you can, you might see green. If you're non-white, you might see red. If you're a homosexual, you might see yellow, something like that. You can't possibly understand other groups if you're in the dominant group. They have knowledge that you don't. You have to believe this on faith, and you can only listen to them. And when one of the interviews that actually a Christian man had with Jane Lindsay, he pointed out that, you know, after he kind of explained some of this, he said, this is really a faith. You know, you believe in, it's really not relativism, like most of you probably have heard of, where like your truth is your truth and my truth is mine. They actually kind of believe that there is some kind of an objective truth. There is some kind of deeper level of truth, but you have to be in a press group to understand it. But this whole kind of worldview has its own faith. It believes in objective truth with some kind of objective standards, has its own exegetical method or interpretive, you know, kind of method where they view the world. Of course, there's zero science or anything else that could ever prove that, you know, somebody's lived experience has some deeper level of truth than another. Again, you kind of have to take this on faith. In a book called Race, Class, and Gender, it also says the idea that objectivity is best reached through rational thought is a Western and masculine way of thinking that we'll challenge through this book through testimonies, lived experiences of oppressed people. So there again, Vodi Balkum calls this ethnic Gnosticism, that, you know, you have some special knowledge because of your race or because of some other status. But the idea that you can be objective, that you can, you know, use rational thought or scientific methods to come to some conclusion, that's really just a Western way of doing things. It's also been described as the master's appealing to data and science is appealing to the master's tools, system that was devised to justify oppression. And this was kind of in the news this summer, the Modern America Museum of African American History and Culture, which I believe is in Washington, D.C., associates whiteness with hard work, self-reliance, delayed gratification, scientific methods, rational thinking, and several other things. Fortunately, this was later removed. It kind of came under a lot of fire for that. But, you know, I thought it was kind of ironic because you couldn't have, you know, nice civilized cities with museums if you didn't have all those things. So there weren't people that in the past had worked hard and, you know, delayed their gratification, you know, were willing to work hard for long periods, used, you know, methodical, rational thinking, all those kinds of things. You know, that's one reason we all live in, you know, society like we do, with all the benefits and entertainment and arts and music and everything else we have. In another book called Queer Theory, Gender Theory, the author says, objectivity is meaningless when it comes to gender and queerness because the very notion of queerness, the production of some genders is queer, and the search for their origin and meaning are already exertions of power. There was also a controversy a few months ago about somebody tweeting that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not necessarily true. It just, again, that's kind of a masculine Western definition. And Neil Shinby's noted, though, if you press them, they'll sometimes back off these stances, but they'll still say they want to get rid of Western structures and colonialism and all the things that they believe has oppressed people. But I also think it's quite a contradiction that a lot of the same people that promote this, or at least seem to have no problem with this being taught, are the same people that call themselves the people of science or the party of science, you know, when it comes to things like when they talk about climate change or COVID, that, you know, they believe this. Of course, there's different, very different views depending on which scientists you listen to, but some of the same people that are constantly talking about we have to have science and data, and even some of the more liberal Christians who will deny some of the miracles because it just doesn't seem to, you know, map up with science, are now falling for this, which is just, you know, says you can just throw all that out the window if, you know, if you're talking about some kind of power struggle between different groups. Two college professors, one of them was James Lindsay, and another one was a philosophy professor from Oregon, and a magazine editor, actually just to kind of show how there's so little rigor in this type of thinking, and how almost anything goes as long as it kind of fits this narrative. They actually wrote a bunch of fake academic papers as a hoax, and seven journals actually accepted them, and four published them. Like one of them was called Rape Culture and Queer Performativity at Urban Dog Parks. I mean, that just the title alone. There was another one about that was in the Fat Studies. There's a Fat Studies journal, apparently, and it was about kind of redefining bodybuilding in terms of fatness. You know, just kind of ridiculous things. Another term that you hear is whiteness. James Cone, who's one of the kind of leading liberation theologists and kind of another pioneer in this type of thinking, talks about getting people to hate their whiteness. There's actually a major evangelical publisher that published a book which grew out of a series from a major seminary called Can White People Be Saved? Believe it or not. As whiteness is best understood as a religious system of pagan idol worship that thrives on a mutually reinforcing circularity. Go through all the wording there. As an idolatry, whiteness must be dealt with like any such cultic system. Its high places must be torn down and its altars laid low. The purpose of this paper is to offer a few concrete practices in which white folks must engage to begin casting down our white idols. And they would say that whiteness is not necessarily your skin color, but this kind of this whole system of thought and mindset that they associate with colonialism and rational thinking and this sort of thing. Wokeness is also, though, very legalistic. And this is especially kind of true in an important topic when we talk about the church accepting this, and there are, I didn't really put together a list of names or anything, but I did mention in the Southern Baptist Convention, a traditionally very conservative, probably the largest conservative denomination, this is making inroads. It is as well in the PCA. I think pretty much all the mainline denominations have all been gone for decades, and they obviously would buy into this very easily as well. But for those that do and that accept things like anti-racism, one of the key tenets of anti-racism is that the work is never done. It's unlike the finished work of Christ. Robin DiAngelo says that if you don't agree, you don't have the racial stamina to do the work. And if you walk away from it, you're too fragile. She just has like every excuse you possibly have, there's something wrong with you. You know, you're just being a racist. I found it's especially interesting that, you know, in some Christian circles where there's been very little emphasis on God's law or a need for holiness, there's been kind of a hyper-grace movement that just kind of tries to do away with most of our need to follow. Not that we're saved by doing our works in some way save us, but they are a chief and integral part of Christianity. But even in some of those circles, people are pushing anti-racism, which is, you know, kind of ironic because they're supposedly against all, you know, people pushing works and being Pharisees, but that's exactly what they're doing with this. And unfortunately, that this anti-racism is nowhere found in the Bible. It's not even like a bad application of, you know, somebody being legalistic, but trying to at least do something that's biblical. Some denominations have made corporate confessions, you know, for racism multiple times, and it seems like there's still a push for more. You know, it's whether it's slavery or segregation and Jim Crow laws, and I won't really get into that. I mean, there's different views on whether or not we should make corporate confession for those things, but when it's been done several times already and there's still talk of doing more, it just makes you, you know, again, think that there's no real end to this. It's a non-ending thing. There's no real atonement. Derek Bell, who's a Harvard law professor, who really is the first guy who used the term critical race theory, also says it's an interest convergence theory. It means basically when you're following and trying to be an anti-racist and follow CRT, you're doing it at least partially for your own interest. You're trying to get some kind of extra status or position yourself better. So there again, if you're doing this, you're, as a white person, then you're, and this could be applied to other things too. It could be, men trying to be a feminist or heterosexual trying to be sympathetic with homosexual. Again, this is just the kind of the biggest issue right now in our culture is the racial thing, that when you're doing this, that you're doing it some for your own benefit. Maybe you're just trying to cover yourself. You're trying to make yourself look good. So again, you can't ever really do it right. There's always something you're doing wrong. There's always something to improve. So again, as James Lindsay, himself an atheist, kind of surprisingly says, it's similar to total depravity. It corrupts every part of you. But, unlike Christianity, there's no ultimate forgiveness. There's no finishing work that will take care of it. Now, as to why this has grown so much and why Christians are finding it appealing, probably several things. One thing Neil Shinvey mentions is that, Christians want to be against legitimate oppression and racism. They know those things are wrong, so they have a listening ear for this, and sometimes feel the kind of guilt that's pushed within this. Some Christians think they can read some of these books and read these authors and filter it through their Christian worldview. Neil Shinvey he likens this to Christians saying, I can eat the meat and spit out the bones. He said it's more like eating the meat and spitting out the poison. So there's really no way to do it. That's not to say that some mature Christians need to read this and, so they can be discerning and teach others about it. But as far as trying to, pick and choose and that sort of thing, it's just the positions are just too unbiblical and really just too toxic to be able to use them in any helpful way. He also said it's kind of like telling a Christian struggling with anxiety to go read a book about Buddhist spirituality. There's also the social pressure. Nobody wants to get called a racist. A lot of young people see all their friends wearing a BLM shirts and using rainbow stickers, and it's hard for them not to give in. And my own son, Merritt, said that I'd be surprised to see all the people who have posted things on social media from even, conservative Christian circles, that it's surprising how many people have accepted this, at least to some extent. And I think part of it too is just sort of the nature of it and the kind of the propaganda. Noam Chomsky, who's a really famous linguist who's very far to the left, but he said that the point of propaganda is to pick a phrase no one can disagree with. Black Lives Matter. No one's going to disagree with that in and of itself. You may qualify, to say all lives matter and that sort of thing, which a lot of people don't like, but the phrase itself is hard for somebody to argue with. In a 1989 book called After the Ball that was really written by two Harvard professors to really push at the time I think it was just called the gay movement, it was before all the alphabet. They had a threefold strategy, and I've never read the book. I've heard several people talk about it, but apparently it's just raw. They just write out there they wanted to push this agenda. They had very little respect for people who didn't hold their worldview, and that they were just very open in the book about how this could be done. And it definitely was done. They said the three stages were desensitizing, which is like a continuous flood of movies, TV shows, commercials. You think of all this stuff in the sitcoms in the 90s and movies like Philadelphia and things like that that presented it as very you know, wholesome, good people, often the heroes of the stories. There's jamming, which is smearing anyone who opposes or associates anyone who opposes this with being like a KKK or neo-Nazis. Definitely seen a lot of that with the modern woke movement. And then conversion, which is converting the average American's emotions, mind, and will through a planned psychological attack. These are also the three phases of brainwashing, which the authors note in the book. And I know just pretty much out of time, so let me just go through this really quickly. Why CRT and Christianity are incompatible, and this is mostly taken from the work of Neil Shinby. Both are comprehensive, coherent worldviews. They both answer fundamental questions about our identity, our ethics, and our epistemology. Christianity says you are a creature of a loving, holy, and good God. You're made in God's image, a sinner, and you need a Savior. Christianity, though, starts with our own injustice. Every one of us is an individual, no matter what group we're in or what we look like. It all starts with our own injustice and sin. We're all on the wrong side of history until we know Christ. CRT, your identity is found in different groups vying for power defined by race, color, or sex. In ethics, CRT, just one example, believes the whole gender binary is oppressive. So somebody, in other words, somebody who doesn't identify as fully male or female, that's just an evil. They should be able to be anywhere on that, you know, that scale of male to female that they want to be. And if you say they can't, that's oppressive. For Christians, God created us male and female, and that's a good thing. That's from, you know, the very beginning of Genesis. And so you just can't have that contradiction there. You can't say gender binary is oppressive, yet I still hold to the Christian worldview. It's also worth noting that as far as ethics, only certain forms of racism seem to be attacked. Darwinian racism, of Darwin's original claims of blacks evolving from stronger, less intelligent apes is practically never mentioned, nor is abortion, where 30% of the abortions are performed on 13% of the population. And then when it comes to epistemology, CRT believes that truth is determined by your social location, you know, where you fit in, which groups, and your lived experience. If you're a white male, you're oppressed, you're an oppressor who's blinded by your social location. Now, you can't, if you go and quote to one of the CRT folks, Bodhi Balcom or somebody like Thomas Sowell, you know, really great, economist who happens to be black and really just a great social commenter, that doesn't really count because they are speaking from white adjacency, as they call it. They've internalized their whiteness and oppression. And again, in their epistemology, oppressed people have better access to the truth, so you really can't appeal to scripture, reason, tradition, or anything else if you're blinded. And I think I'll stop there because it's about 3 minutes over, so. Got any other questions or anything, or be happy to talk to you afterwards. Maybe I can send Rich a few of the links if you want to add them to the email, a few of the podcasts and things like that. So there's a lot of good information on it.